Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of our show, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. I'm glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Kyle Mabry at the controls this morning. There are today something between 40 and 60 nations, home to close to a billion people, that have either collapsed or standing right on the edge of failure. Some of the worst problems we have in the world today, things like terrorism and drug and human trafficking, genocide, originate in such places. The international community has literally spent billions of dollars in trying to help these countries, for the most part, without great success. In this hour of our show, we'll be talking a bit about the problem, why it is that states fail, and what it is that the rest of the world can do to help. And we have with us two guests, Ashraf Ghani and Claire Lockhart, and they are both associated with the Institute for State Effectiveness, which is based in Washington, D.C. Ashraf Ghani has taught at Johns Hopkins and at Kabul University. He worked at the World Bank. He served as finance minister of Afghanistan and has been credited with a range of successful reforms in that country in the years following 9/11. Recently, he was a finalist for both the jobs of the U.N. Secretary General and president of the World Bank, and now he is the chairman of the Institute for State Effectiveness. Claire Lockhart is director of the Institute. She's worked for the World Bank and the United Nations. She's trained as a barrister. She helped write the Bonn Agreement that formed the Afghan government. And during her years in Kabul, she played a key leadership role in developing the national program's approach to Afghanistan's reconstruction efforts. The two of them together have co-authored a book. The title is Fixing Failed States, A Framework for Rebuilding a Fractured World. It is published by the Oxford University Press. Certainly, you could find it in a bookstore if you're interested in reading it. And of course, questions are welcome from people who are listening. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people just try to keep their comments and questions brief so that we can keep our program moving along. Anyone who's listening, though, certainly can join in. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. So that's if you are here where we are, use that number. But there's also a toll-free line, and that means that if you're listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana or across the country on the Internet, you may use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL or 9455. That's the local number and toll free, 800-222-9455. Dr. Ghani, hello.
Good morning. Pleasure to be with you.
Glad to have you talking with us. And Ms. Lockhart, hello.
Good morning. Pleasure to be on air with you.
Well, we're glad that you could be with us. Yesterday, a colleague of mine was passing by my desk and saw your book sitting on the desk. And naturally, his very first question essentially was, how does one define a failed state? So perhaps that'd be good to start there, and not only with a definition, but perhaps also with an example or two.
A state, we argue, performs 10 functions. So success and failure are operational. They're not a slogan to be used against those governments that one dislikes and those that one likes. For instance, infrastructure is one of those functions. The American Society of Civil Engineers has ranked the performance of the federal government in the United States as being C- at best. And this is resulting in a huge discussion in this country that $1.5 trillion are going to be required in the next 5 years to move and address the question. And we saw it with the failure of the bridge in Wisconsin that then resulted in a public discussion. But in a functioning overall country and where the government is functioning, then priorities are reordered to address this. Failure is when a state as such fails. It is when it fails to perform most of these functions. The most illustrative example, of course, now is the first function, the oldest function of the state, which is security. A number of countries, and that, of course, is what we see on a daily news basis in Iraq, where the government cannot guarantee the security of the ordinary citizens, and because that, millions of people have left the country, have become refugees, and the number of people who have died as a result of the violence that has been inflicted upon them is again depending on whose estimates one believes, runs into thousands.
So you would argue that the definition and the determination of what we might consider a failed state can be made on a set of objective criteria, and it would be the kind of thing that, generally speaking, you got a group of people together, economists, political scientists, people like that. There would be general agreement out of on what was a failed state and one was not. And then if you're looking at specific countries, it's the kind of thing where, generally speaking, there would be agreement.
Yes, a twofold process.
Yeah.
One is an agreement of experts on which now we have 20 years of experience regarding building of indices and others. But more fundamentally, it's the judgment of the citizens of that place, the ordinary people who judge this, and Ms. Lockhart will give you some examples.
Certainly, and absolutely. One of the key arguments that we're making is that the state can't just be a top-down repressive instrument. It has to be one that enjoys legitimacy and the support and buy-in of the citizens. And as such, one of its primary definitions is to be accountable to the citizens of a country. Some examples of this. In 2005, the World Bank and UN kindly convened a conference where they looked at the framework we're proposing. And the participants in the conference were 12 leaders of post-conflict transitions. And they looked at the framework. We proposed 10 functions. They actually wanted to add two more. One was the ability to look after refugees and manage the transitional justice process in conditions of extreme conflict and tragedy. The other was that the state itself should acquire the capability to manage disaster, to provide disaster relief, so the state doesn't always have to rely on external foreign agencies to do that. And that is a really pertinent question, of course, as we watch the tragedies of Myanmar and China unfold in these recent days. Examples of how citizens can judge their country will be the leaders at this conference were able to do it very quickly, and they were able to almost draw a scorecard of how well the state were performing functions, both at the beginning of the process that they'd led and 5 years down the road, and see how it had changed. And they were very surprised, actually, at the results. And to see it on paper and look at these indicators, they found extremely helpful. It provided a sort of map so they could see where they were coming from and where they were going, where the key sticky challenges were. Other examples, in putting the book together, our colleagues and Dr. Ghani and I have looked at a number of different countries, including spending time on the ground in Nepal, in Kosovo, southern Sudan, Lebanon, and other places. And what we find is that even in a short number of days, the citizens of the countries, we've talked to them across the country in different groups, whether it's university professors, students, editors of newspapers, businessmen and women, representatives of the government, very quickly it's possible to put together a picture of how well the state is performing and where the problems are. And these citizens have a very sharp sense, acute sense of where the problems lie.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that the difficulty in terms of intervention, the difficulty here that I'm sure again and again one bumps your head against is the issue of national sovereignty. And you don't have to look any further than the questions over the government of Myanmar or Burma, whichever you prefer, to see an example of that. Just in what sort of in what way can the rest of the countries in the world, even if they all agree on what would be good, in what way can they intervene? What sort of levers do they have to persuade a government to do anything, something or anything, if that government resists?
An excellent question. Myanmar or Burma is the exception. In most of the rest of the world, the international community has a series of instruments. First, there's the aid system. A lot of the poorest countries of the world are recipients of the aid. The question is how to make the aid functional, because currently the aid system is in crisis. Second, it is the political process of recognition. Seats at the UN, One has to end membership in international organizations. Where the discussion is moving is that sovereignty no longer is just about rights. It is also about obligations. So twofold sets of obligations. One, to their own citizens, because that is the source of internal legitimacy and stability. Second, to the international community. Third is trade. Trade, again, in investment or becoming instruments. And fourth is naming and shaming. In terms, in former Yugoslavia, one of the most important sanctions that took place was actually to deny the Milosevic regime visas and name them in terms of people who are violating human rights. So there is an entire range of instruments. The key is to make the international system functional so these can be wielded in a fair way. Because today, the main objection is that there's a double standard, that when certain governments that are aligned with certain powers behave in certain ways, they are tolerated while those of others are criticized. And if it were applied in a fair way with consistency, the international community would have a lot more credibility to be able to persuade these types of governments to play much more by fairer rules, both with their own people and with their neighbors in the international community at large.
Well, it seems that there is a very serious issue, and I'm sure that people can provide their own examples. How does one move then to a point where you don't have double standards and you do have a whatever sort of principles that you want to apply or tools that you want to use, you do use them in a fair way, at least in the sense that everyone gets treated the same way?
This is precisely, the question regarding the role of the United States. As the indispensable power in the world, the investment that the U.S. during its next presidency makes or does not make in the international organizations and in it arriving at a set of rules with other partners would be critical to the credibility of an international approach. Contrast the approach to Afghanistan and to Iraq. In Afghanistan, the entire international community rose with one voice after 9/11 to justify military intervention, and the people of Afghanistan received it with open arms and greeted the soldiers as liberators and welcomed a democratic process. And that international conditions in Afghanistan are not what we hoped for, but the international legitimacy is very much there. By contrast, the intervention in Iraq was unilateral, and one of the core problems is still that. So lessons need to be drawn from that in the right coalition for building fair standards that are applied fairly need to be arrived at. That becomes much more to the benefit of powers in general and the indispensable power, the United States in particular.
Hmm. And anything, Ms. Lockhart, that you want to add to that?
Certainly, in general, what we're arguing is that there's a double failure, and absolutely, as you cite the example of sovereignty, we really need a fresh look at sovereignty. What we argue in the book is that there's a sovereignty gap. Mm-hmm. A number of states are not performing the functions that their citizens expect of them, and the international community requires them to perform in order to be stable. And this sovereignty gap is really at the root cause of a lot of problems that we're seeing, ranging from poverty, instability, insecurity, and even climate change. Climate change isn't going to be addressed until states are performing functions in a really responsible way. And so coming up with new instruments to address this sovereignty gap is key, and we propose a range of mechanisms, as Dr. Ghani has described. We also believe there's a tremendous opportunity at the moment with the new presidents going through their presidential campaigns and come the months running up to January, an enormous opportunity to redefine imaginative ways of tackling this challenge.
We have two guests, and let me quickly introduce them, reintroduce them, and I have a caller that we'll get right to. The last person you heard is Claire Lockhart. She is director of the Institute for State Effectiveness in Washington, D.C. She has also worked for the World Bank and the U.N. During her years in Afghanistan, in Kabul, she was very involved in developing the national programs approach to the reconstruction efforts there. Also joining us is Dr. Ashraf Ghani. He was the finance minister of Afghanistan. He has also been very much involved in reforms in that country after 9/11. He's also taught a number of places at Johns Hopkins, at Berkeley, at Kabul University. He's worked at the World Bank and was a finalist for the job of Secretary General of the United Nations. The two of them together are co-authors of a book that explores this subject that we're talking about here. The title of their book is Fixing Failed States, A Framework for Rebuilding a Fractured World. It's published by the Oxford University Press. We have a caller here in Urbana where we are who'd like to join in, so let's do that. Line number one. Hello.
Oh, hi, how are you?
Yeah.
Not a very envious position you guys are in, because the problem is so vast. I mean, just this morning, there's a thing on the British BBC about Ethiopia where there are 600,000 children are probably going to earn verge of starving to death. And then the article further added that, you know, 10 years ago, the World Health Organization had moved in, you know, in force and assisted women in, you know, prenatal vitamins and getting these children to survive instead of having a high death rate at birth. So you had all these, you know, like let's say the other population is growing at 2 million a year, yet they can't feed each other. I'm wondering if, and if you were speaking of this double standard where some countries sort of get away with, you know, like Zimbabwe doing in their own people, Myanmar and all that stuff. And do you think a lot of that came about from the Cold War where you had this, you know, separate, like the communists, and if you're anti-communist from the West, you could kind of do what you wanted to do as long as you weren't a communist? Do you have any information? Would you say that's valid?
Very much so.
Mm-hmm.
We are describing a lot of these failed states as the debris of the Cold War.
Yeah.
Between 1946 and 49, the statesmen who've now been known as the wise men and women confronted the world in utter chaos. And Dean Acheson titled his memoirs, Present at Creation, because it reminded them of the first chapter of Genesis.
Hmm.
And they attempted to get half the world right. And it's remarkable that they succeeded. But the problem was that the other half, you know, one went communist, and in between emerged this space where the Cold War was actually hot. And a lot of places were judged not by standards like human rights
mm-hmm.
or transparency, but by which side they sided with. So they were ours or theirs. It became a black and white process. This resulted in an entire range of dictatorships being supported and becoming acceptable that destroyed the basis of rule of law and credibility of administration and services.
Mm-hmm.
And now, with the end of the Cold War, people thought, well, they could sort themselves out.
Mm-hmm.
And then the horrific conflicts in the Balkans emerged, and then, of course, Afghanistan and the new series of conflicts in the Middle East. So this has now really emerged as one of the core challenges of the 21st century as to how to create capable states in places that previously were being viewed from one perspective. What is nice is that given the successful transformation of that first half of the world,
mm-hmm.
the resources, wisdom, and the capabilities now really exist that we can tackle this remaining part. So we are optimistic rather than pessimistic.
Yeah, and I'm really admirable. That's admirable you're that way. I was going to ask you a question. I mean, you were talking about Myanmar and how the government, it's like we could go to Rwanda in the 90s, how governments turn on their own citizen or allow other citizens of their, you know, like they split the country in half and say, you can kill these half, and we're the rulers now. How do we deal with that? I mean, without, you were talking about sovereignty, and I was making some notes about the system in crisis and stuff like that. And like I saw a thing on BBC where they interviewed this guy, well, they blocked his face, and he said, I wish somebody would come in here and help us. You know, just who cares about those guys up north, you know, the rulers. And when is it appropriate to do that? Not like George Bush saying, let's get rid of Saddam Hussein.
But, no, of course.
Yeah, I mean, but it's interesting. I mean, it's a real challenge. But I was always concerned about the people that are on the ground, you know, the people that just want to be left alone and go back and do their have their lives, and how they're so just targeted, like in Zimbabwe now with, you know, the ZANU-PF, and they're killing all the people that don't like. And, I mean, everybody just sort of stands back and goes, well, the way it is. But thank you, and I really admire you people, for both of you, for your work. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your comments. And just a further comment on your excellent comments just there. Absolutely. There are certainly cases where the humanitarian imperative is overwhelming. And there's a very interesting new doctrine sponsored by a number of countries, including the Canadians, called the responsibility to protect. There are times when provision of really saving lives is necessary. What we're arguing is that over the medium to long term, it's not going to be possible to provide aid. There just isn't enough money in budgets to respond to crises at the last minute over and over again. And unless we develop collectively systems of proper governance, both in the international community and within the countries themselves, we're not going to be able to respond to the number of crises. There are not just Iraq and Afghanistan, of course, as you well know. There are 40 to 60 countries that are suffering from endemic conflict and poverty and suffering. And what we argue is that there's a double failure. There's a failure of the international system and also a failure of governments to respond. Enormous cases of exclusion of citizenries. And what we need to do is think about how do we create systems of good governance? How do we ensure that there are systems in place where all the citizens of a country have equal access to services, rights of participation, and rights to benefit from, in fact, the enormous wealth that's present in many of these countries. Often we look at the countries as we see the outward signs of poverty, and then we overlook the enormous wealth ranging from the land, the water, the minerals, and the human capability of the country that could make them wealthy.
We talked a little bit earlier, or you mentioned, Dr. Ghani mentioned the fact that when we were talking about what exactly do we consider to be a failed state, that in the book that you argue that there are these 10 basic functions that the state has, and they include, as you mentioned, providing infrastructure, security, also other things like creation of citizenship rights, investing in human capital, sound management of public finances and assets, just to name a few of those things. I'm not going to go down the entire list. But those are some, just so people have a sense of what we're talking about, those are the things that we're talking about. If you take a look at some of the places that you would consider to be failed states because they're not doing this, do you think that it is the case that those who are governing or attempting to govern these states are failing because they are not able to make progress in these areas, either because they simply don't have the experience or the expertise, the knowledge, or because things in those states are so chaotic that it's difficult to do this? Or is it that they could if they wanted to, but for their own reasons, no doubt going to the question of maintaining their position of power, they somehow think that these things are not important, or that they would reduce their ability to control their population? So is it that they can't, or is it that they would choose not to?
It's both. Because in a number of countries, you have people who genuinely care to change and have a rupture with discriminatory, with predatory practices of the past. For instance, if you take Liberia today, that is led by a very able woman with enormous respect. Here, the question is capabilities. And in a place like Liberia, it is the shortcomings of the international aid system to really partner and to be able to offer the assistance that is necessary. For instance, after 60 years of involvement with public finance management, neither the IMF nor the World Bank has a handbook as to how to go from a very corrupt system of budgeting to one in public finance management and what are the steps to it. They've generalized notions and have segmented it, but they've not come with an approach. So the finance minister of Liberia was incredibly clean and devoted to public service, is actually spending in a substantial part of her time managing the budget on a weekly basis. So there is willingness, capacity, and the lack of the international system to tailor workable solutions and to provide options that can be adapted to context is the problem. Another side is just the opposite. You take a lot of countries with oil wealth. They do not disclose the money from oil revenue to their public because they do want to control it privately. And there, it is personal interest. In between are a number of other places where disorder is preferred to order. So criminalization of the economy reaches a point where the government becomes an extension of criminal interests. And in these types of situations, the challenge, of course, is far bigger because it's not the absence of will for positive change, but significant stakes in the system of narrow interest. So the choices, 100 or 10 or 20 individuals or families become millionaires or even billionaires, but tens of million or hundreds of million remain poor. During the Abacha regime, for instance, in Nigeria, one of the richest countries in Africa, billions of dollars were transferred to foreign accounts. And there, again, the collusion of the international banking system makes this type of robbery possible.
As I mentioned, both of you have worked at the World Bank. I suppose that there are some people who would argue that there are places around the world we might identify as failed states, and that these large international financial organizations like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, by their policies, have in fact made things worse.
We have no difficulty with this. Our critique of these failed policies is very trenchant. And you can see that today. In 1998, the IMF failed to rise to the challenge of the East Asian financial crisis. It, like generals fighting the previous war, it responded with medication to East Asia that had been derived from conditions of Latin America. What's been the net result? All the major economies of East Asia have accumulated enormous reserves. China's is $1.6 trillion, so that they will not be dealing with the IMF. As a result, the IMF has become quite marginal to the management of the current global monetary policy, and this year is laying off 300 individuals from its staff. The World Bank is faced a substantial crisis over the tenure of its last president that resulted in that resignation. But today, I think, is rethought quite imaginatively a set of priorities under its new president. The issue is whether these new priorities would actually be implementable. There's a culture of technical assistance and project or orientation focus that, in our argument, does not result in sustained change. So the fact that we've worked there is not a reflection of endorsement of the institution's capability. Both of these institutions were 20th century institutions. They need to be brought to the 21st century to acquire the skills, capabilities, and imaginations to respond to the test. But if they didn't exist, we would be reinventing them. So the issue is not their abolition, but fundamental transformation and reform so they can be useful.
And just to illustrate on the ground, putting the book together, we've had discussions with citizens in a number of different countries across the world and find this immense wisdom in the ordinary citizens of the country. One of the citizens we discussed with in Nepal, she was actually a leader of one of the civil society organizations, said, you, sort of meaning the UN, the World Bank, you come every 2 years, you come with a different set of language, a different concept or a different theme. One year it's sustainable development, then it's governance, and then it's something else. And she said, you know, we try really hard to learn your language, and we learn it. And just as we're getting to the point where we think we can speak it and we've rewritten all our project documents, then you change the language on us again. So I think really one of the key questions for organizations like the UN and the World Bank is to take a much longer-term perspective. Instead of planning for these small projects on a one-year or two-year time horizon, they're the maximum they're usually planned in a three-year time cycle, how can we look towards much longer-time horizons, the 10 to 15 years that institution building and transformation requires to take root?
And I think that gets at an important issue, I think, and I'm certain that it's one that you would respond to, and that is that, yes, it is true, as an earlier caller indicated, there have been times when the international community is confronted with a conflict at a particular place and feel so overwhelmed by it that they simply throw up their hands and say, well, you know, there's nothing that we can do about that. The fact is, there have been many places around the country where the international community has tried to get involved to help and indeed has spent significant amounts of money. So I suppose one has to ask, in those places where there has been a great deal of money spent, either by governmental or non-governmental organizations, why is it that the money that has been spent hasn't, you know, why is it, to use the proverbial phrase, why has there not been more bang for the buck?
The issue, again, is fundamentally of the system design. You take the Marshall Plan, everybody now, globally and nationally in the United States, agrees that this was critical to Europe's survival. What people forget is that there were six alternative alternatives regarding how money should be spent. One of those alternatives was a project model of assistance on which currently the World Bank's and other developmental institutions' approach is based. Had that design been chosen, in retrospect, there's very sound analysis, we would have not been able to get the type of recovery in Europe that we have succeeded in. So one reason we are not getting enough bang for the buck is the way the aid system is structured is a problem. For instance, any set of projects that go through USAID are contracted first to a series of firms around the Beltway, then each of them subcontracts. We counted, for instance, that in Afghanistan this could go through as many as six layers of subcontracting. So by the time the money reaches the contractor on the ground, fully 80% of it has been paid for the cost of administration. Take the other example. The U.S. public has been incredibly generous in supporting food programs. The United States currently spends $2 billion a year on food aid. Next year, the proposal is for $5 billion. Fully 65% of this is cost of administration and shipping. This is one reason. So if we are counting the real value of money that gets to the ground, it's far less than the billions that actually go through the treasury here or in Europe or other places. Second, the aid system, again, focused on individualized projects. So when NGOs are sent, for instance, after a tsunami, they did not create coordination mechanism. One NGO did not know what the other NGOs were doing. We were in Banda Aceh in Indonesia, and the people on the ground were incredibly dissatisfied with the type of housing that was built for them, because it was not done with their advice and taking into account their extended families. They were built for single families. And it had been very slow, and some of the large international NGOs that have been at the forefront of demand for accountability and transparency, actually when they were given contracts, failed to perform on the same standards themselves. Third, and this is at the heart of our argument, governance systems have not received substantial attention and investment. We design what we call national accountability systems that have been at the core of functioning systems. For instance, in Ireland or Spain or Singapore, in the southern states of the United States, a local contracting industry that could absorb the money effectively and use it to create value has been essential. Most of the governments, and this is not often realized, have actually a lot of difficulty spending money. The prime example of this is Iraq today. As the surge is, the military surge has gone up, the government of Iraq is reduced its own expenditure on projects, on development, from 10 billion to 4 by a factor of 65%. This is an indication that we need a different approach to system design and to set of capabilities that would allow us to deal with this.
Absolutely. Just to illustrate further, I think at the root of the problems in the aid system, so that's first the salami slicing down the contractual chain. If you do have five or six layers, it's not surprising there's any money next to the bottom. We've got to relook at the way that procurement takes place. And what are the second question here is the accountabilities. There's sometimes very little oversight of these contracts, and the Government Accountability Office of Congress has been at the forefront of identifying both cases of abuse and the systemic problems and suggestions of how to deal with. Third, in setting up these myriad aid projects, it actually sometimes, even if the project itself is delivered well and is completed, the net effect of these numbers of projects together, in this process, the whole becomes far less than the sum of the parts and even causes damage. Why? Because in setting up these projects, the NGOs, UN agencies, contractors pay very, very high salaries in contexts and circumstances where there's a shortage because of the years of war of trained personnel. There just wasn't, during years of war, investment in human capital. Rather, there was a flight of human capital, often with millions of people sometimes going into exile. So what happens is the people who used to be doctors, teachers, engineers, get sucked away from their positions to become drivers, assistants, and translators for this project system. Sometimes these projects, ironically, are designed to do capacity building for the schools and clinics that are now empty. So we get this absurd situation where actually sometimes this aid effort becomes an effort in state destruction, and the net effect over a period of years of this is to destroy the capacity that was actually there at the beginning. And this is a very worrying problem. We really need collectively to look at this, particularly as there's all sorts of, with the generosity of citizens across the world, and rightly so, to the aid system. You know, the need to invest in these places is overwhelming. The case has been made. But it's the how-to of expenditure that needs a really fresh look to make sure that this new money that's becoming available through foundations, through the calls of the NGOs to increase donations to the aid system, doesn't actually end up creating unintended consequences. And there are, it's not that there doesn't need to be this investment, absolutely there does. There are a number of positive examples of instruments, and we cite the case of national programs and examples in many parts of the world, including Afghanistan, where these were put into practice, and really imaginative instruments like risk guarantee, use of financial instruments that the aid system can bring both capital and knowledge to putting into place. The Overseas Private Investment Corporation in the U.S. As one example of a way to do this, where aid can actually have a really catalytic and positive impact on a situation.
We have about 10 minutes left, and I have a caller we get right to. Just I hope that person will not mind if I make them wait 30 seconds longer, long enough to reintroduce our guests, Claire Lockhart and Ashraf Ghani. Claire Lockhart is director of the Institute for State Effectiveness. It's based in Washington, D.C. This is an independent international institution that's interested in trying to promote global security and prosperity by developing new ways to help enhance the capabilities of fragile states. She has worked for the World Bank and the UN. Our other guest, Dr. Ashraf Ghani, he's taught a number of places here in this country, Johns Hopkins, Berkeley, and also in Kabul University. He worked at the World Bank. He served as finance minister of Afghanistan and has been credited with a range of successful reforms in that country in the years following 9/11. Claire Lockhart also worked there in Afghanistan, very much involved in developing the national programs approach to the country's reconstruction efforts. The two of them co-authors of a book that's titled Fixing Failed States, a Framework for Rebuilding a Fractured World, published by the Oxford University Press. We have a caller here to bring into the conversation, someone in Spring Bay. So they're on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Yes.
Thanks for taking my call. You look at Sudan and Iraq and the Central Asian republics, with all their oil wealth, and it seems to me that these countries have been taken over by oil thugs who are basically just taking the wealth of the country for their own private ends. But I'm very frustrated these days watching the news with Burma, and that military junta there seems to me to be, again, just taking the wealth out of that country and not distributing it at all to the people. And I have to put some responsibility on China, because I think China is really making advantage through that junta, being able to have access to Burma's raw materials and mineral wealth. And it seems to me that this is a wonderful opportunity for the international community, with China getting ready for the Summer Olympics, to really put pressure on the Chinese to step up and be a little bit more responsible in terms of a world citizen to get something going there. And I'm just wondering if you could make some comments on those, and I'll talk. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for that. China is a rising power in this century, is being called the century of the Pacific or Asia. And with enhanced status, economic and political, comes responsibility. The phrase that the Chinese have liked, that the former Deputy Secretary of the United States, current President of the World Bank, used, was a responsible stakeholder. And this frame really needs a lot of attention to seeing what a global responsible stakeholder needs to do in the region and to wield its influence. So the discussion really needs to be an encompassing discussion, because the weight of China is going to be quite significant, and its development, political, and economic profile needs to be brought together within an international values perspective that can enhance its reputation, and that needs to be arrived at with its leadership.
All right, I hope that gets at the question of the caller. Others are welcome. Again, we have about maybe 5 minutes left in this part of Focus. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. A little earlier in the program, we're talking about your argument that there are essentially 10 functions that the state has, and you can look at how well the state fulfills those functions and use that as your criteria to decide what is a failed state and what is not, and perhaps who is on the brink. One of those 10 functions is the sound management of public assets, and that seems to me to be maybe one crucial issue. At least we see that in an awful lot of places. Those people who are in power managing public assets, not for the public good, but for their good, and the fact that there are certainly outside parties that are quite willing to help them do that.
Absolutely. This is one reason where we have called for lawyers without borders, because a lot of these assets are actually negotiated through legal agreements, where a group, an isolated group of individuals, literally sell the birthrights of their country for a pot of porridge. Once a proposal came that we were able to stop in Afghanistan, where a concession had been secured for 40 years for $1 a year. And it obligated the government of Afghanistan literally to hundreds of millions of dollars of expenditure. One really needs to be able to look at assets of a country not being just oil or mineral wealth, but also things like licensing, the banking system, property rights, so that these are watered today, because it is this complex of assets that enables us to arrive at the framework. And we have argued that countries like companies must have balance sheets, and Ms. Lockhart can enter them.
Absolutely. It's really remarkable. Yes, when you have a company, it's obligated to report not only on its cash flow, but also on what it's done with its assets, its balance sheet. How is it acquired new assets? How well has it made use of the assets that it has, the land, the facilities, even the brand of the company? Countries, by contrast, have no such obligations according to an internationally agreed framework. And whilst they do, and the World Bank pays attention to the cash flow from year to year, they don't pay full attention, and there isn't the standard reporting framework for them to pay attention to how, as a country, acquired and sold its licenses for what amount of money. The Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative absolutely has pulled attention to this issue. But there are many other assets, including the land, the water, and even the brand of the country. How is that country perceived in the world? How are its leaders projecting its image? And we're arguing that if we had such a framework, it would really help not only the citizens of the country to hold their own governments accountable, but also some of the international organizations to identify the right issues to confront.
One more caller here, at least, in the time that we have, is someone on a cell phone on our line one. Hello.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, I've enjoyed listening while driving here this morning. One quick comment. I believe the authors, well-renowned, well-certified to speak. However, they're ignoring 1,000 years of history, but all you have to do is go back to 1920. The definition of country or state that you're talking about failed Mideast Africa. First off, were they? They weren't even countries. They weren't states. They were tribal. Most of the problems were created after the post-World War I by the powers, the Western powers, Britain, France, and the U.S. Russia was emerging at that time. And in Africa, today, tribal. You're not a member of a state. You're not a member of a country. You have to be part of the ruling tribe. Tribes go back 2,000 years. There's no difference today between a Zulu ruling in 1750, 1800, versus what's ruling in the old Nigeria today. And until that mentality, until they can emerge, you're never going to solve anything by aid. Thank you.
Well, I'm interested in your thoughts, particularly on the issue. I'd say the larger issue is, how is it that one forges a sense of national identity that would transcend any other allegiances or identities that individuals would have, so that there is something of a spirit of the nation and the public good in a large sense?
Absolutely. Excellent question. First, take a country like France. To the end of 19th century, there were 100 different accents. Germany was a collection of isolated tribes. The Romans described them as tribes. So it is not that a tribal identity is a fixed issue that has not been overcome. In North America, look at Canada and the United States. These are places that are composed of immigrants with enormous diversity. What has wielded them together? It has been public policies that have provided bonds of citizenship to people who are otherwise divided. What makes a nation is not natural borders. No border is naturally arrived at. There is no such thing as a natural border. It is a community of imagination, a bond of imagining a future in common, and then creating the institutions that can create the credibility that, regardless of diversity of initial identity, one agrees to a second set of identities that are in common. And that's what then allows the framework to overcome the past and have a rupture with history and move forward.
And to further illustrate with, as we put the book together across many countries, and we had conversations And even where tribal identities were fairly strong, what we heard from citizens in many parts of the world was what they wanted more than anything and what they saw as necessary for them to both participate in this globalizing world but also satisfy their basic needs was the state to function. And it wasn't that they would have one identity only, they could have multiple identities, but they saw the need for the state as a mechanism to perform certain functions for them, including in parts of the world where tribal identities are also strong. One of the first women I interviewed on arriving in Afghanistan in early 2002 was a woman who said, look, I know that the world has committed billions of dollars to Afghanistan, but we don't want it frittered away on the aid system. Couldn't agree with the call more. It's not the aid system that's the issue. So what we need is an accountable state. We need an accountable civil service that's accountable to us.
We are going to have to stop there, and my apologies, we have a caller we cannot take. We're simply here at the end of the time. For people who are interested in reading some more on the subject, you certainly can look at the book that we have talked about here this morning. The title is Fixing Failed States, A Framework for Rebuilding a Fractured World. This book is published by the Oxford University Press, co-authored by our two guests, Claire Lockhart. She is director of the Institute for State Effectiveness, and Dr. Ashraf Ghani. He is the chairman of the Institute for State Effectiveness. It's based in Washington, D.C. And Dr. Ghani, to you, thank you very much.
Pleasure. Thank you for having us.
And Ms. Lockhart, thank you.
Thank you so much.